Craig Campobasso is an award-winning filmmaker, and he's been nominated for several Emmy Awards. He worked behind the scenes on Frank Herbert's Dune and David Lynch movies and two Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, Conan the Destroyer and Total Recall. He has been working on a feature film, Stranger at the Pentagon, based on the book by Frank Strangers. He has recently written an extraterrestrial almanac. He's also working on completed a four-volume autobiography of an extraterrestrial saga. He's going to be talking to us today about his projects and his future film-length feature, Stranger at the Pentagon.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
Welcome, Craig, to Exopolitics Today.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
Good, good. Well, it's been a few years since we last talked. I think last time we talked, I was living in Hawaii, and now I'm here in Key West. And are you still in the LA area?
I still am. I'm still here.
Okay. Well, I know there's a lot of people that maybe don't know about you, so I invite you to just flesh out a little bit the background, your background, especially I think working on the Dune series of a book by Frank Herbert. I think that would be of great interest to people.
Yes, absolutely. By the way, I think, is it this side? Yeah, I just had a little Mohs surgery. That's why I have a Band-Aid on my face, but all is okay. So I actually started in the film business when I was 15. I went to work on Dune right out of high school. Worked on the film for 4 years, and at the same time, the same producers were doing Conan the Destroyer. So I was actually working on both films, and they were both shot at Estudios Churubusco in Mexico City. So now Dune is big again since Denny brought it back in, you know, the for Warner Brothers, the director. And so last year or the year before, I did, there's a wonderful documentary that you can only rent online called The Sleeper Must Awaken. So if you just type that in, you can rent it. It is a great, thorough, investigative documentary on the making of the film. And then this wonderful writer, Max Every, let me see, how can I get it there? There we go. A master. Boy, that's a little hard to do. I'm trying to get in that box. There we go. But you guys get an idea. And really what it is it's the, as you can see, it is everyone talking about their experience on Dune from pre-production to production to post-production to when we all went to England for the royal premiere. And it's really quite interesting to just hear all the actors and the filmmakers and everyone behind the scenes, by the way, who's interviewed, including the studio heads and all of that. So if you're a Dune fan, This is definitely the book for you. There's lots of pictures that I supplied from my personal collection in the book as well. So anyway, after that, the producers just asked me what I wanted to do with my, what did I want to work on in film after Dune was finished? And I said I liked casting. And so she put me on her next film, Rafaela De Laurentiis, on her next film called Taipan. From there, I went to Amazing Stories and became a casting associate for Steven Spielberg. And then I went back to the De Laurentiis and started casting. And I'm still casting today, although I'm also producing, directing, writing screenplays, writing books, etc. And Anyway, and then when I turned 26, right after Amazing Stories concluded, I had a major spiritual awakening, which catapulted me into diving deep into my own spirituality, but really trying to understand what was out there in the great big universe, because I had never really contemplated that before. This waking process, which I'm not going to go into now because it's long, but it was a span of 2 years, and it's sort of going, as they call it, from 0 to 100, and then you're just on the scale of constantly learning and learning and relearning and relearning. And then I had another spiritual awakening in 2014. So what these do is they sort of bump you up to the next tier of consciousness, and that's how these books came about. The Autobiography of an Extraterrestrial Saga. This one's I Am Taran. It's about Taran, who's a Pleiadian fellow. If people are interested, if you're a starseed, it's really all about starseeds. Taran is at Melchizedek, and he teaches all the messengers and mighty messengers, starseeds that are coming into Earth, coming into other worlds as well. But you also get to learn the whole makeup up there. But just one more thing, and then we'll get into what you want to ask me, Michael, is so in around 2019, my former book agents became a small publishing house, and what they did is they married themselves to MUFON and to Red Will Weiser Books. And because he knew of my extensive research on contactee cases, face-to-face contactee cases, over 60 of them that I really learned about, and I went on a bunch of cases. I've even caught extraterrestrials on film. And so he said, look, we want you to write a book for MUFON. And he goes, I already have the name. It's called The Extraterrestrial Species Almanac. And then it's subtitled The Ultimate Guide to Greys, Reptilians, Hybrids, and Nordics. So I really, I said, yeah, I feel very confident that I can write that book just from all of the contactee cases. So actually in the back of the book, and I should have put it in the introduction, about where all of these races came from. But they did come from real contactee cases. They came from hybrids. They came from people who have studied it. But in the back of the book, there's further reading. So if there's a particular race, I give you the book where the information came from. And actually, a lot of these books are now out of print. So I give you the actual website where you can buy them in a PDF format if you're really interested in reading them. But what was interesting is while I was writing the book, I got a phone call from a woman in Canada. She said she was my fourth or fifth cousin. She was looking for information on my mother's father's side. That's how we were related to each other. And I told her, I said, look, my mom told me when I was 12 that my father was my stepfather and that I had a biological father. I never looked at my stepfather as being anything else but my father. But I was curious to just find out, what the medical history was and who my biological father was. I could not find him on the internet. I tried desperately. And anyway, she said, yes, that's what I do for a living, so I'll find him. And she did. Unfortunately, he had passed away in 2006, but she told me he was buried at Forest Lawn. I went down there the next day, asked if they had a name of the person that called to pick up the body, and they did. It was a gentleman with a different last name. And so I came home after visiting his grave, and found this gentleman who happened to live, you know, 5-10 minutes away from me. Interestingly enough, I wrote him a letter, told him my story, stuck the picture in. 2 days later, I got a phone call from his son saying, "My dad got your letter." And I said, "Oh, is he friends with Fred?" And he said, "No, he's actually his half brother." And I said, "Oh, so you're my cousin?" And he goes, "Yeah, I guess so." He said, "Look, this is normally we would just throw something like this away, but because you put your picture in there, you're a doppelganger for Fred." So I went and I met them for dinner and I just said, "Tell me everything about him." And they did. And about an hour into the conversation, they had the same mother, by the way, different fathers. He said, Fred always wanted to go into the Air Force, but he was too young. So he begged my mother to sign a piece of paper to let him into the Air Guard early. And once he was in the Air Guard, once he turned 18, they put him in the Air Force. And then he was in intelligence. And then he said, "Oh, by the way, he was in Project Blue Book." Now, my face literally fell off because that was the last thing I would have expected, is that he was in Project Blue Book, right? And so he proceeded to tell me that when he left the Air Force after some years, he came back here and he ultimately became the head of the building department over at Warner Brothers for building sets for film and TV. So now I understand why I do what I do. I'm in the film business and I write books for MUFON, and he was in the film business and built sets for Warner Brothers, and he worked in Project Blue Book. So I was able to retain his like 2.5-inch military file as well. And the numbers that are on his discharge paper, I've met lots of people throughout my years higher up in the military. And they said they wanted to see it. And they said that those discharge numbers, they have never seen those numbers before. That was very curious to them because they didn't know what it meant. So maybe people in Project Blue Book have different numbers. So I just found that interesting.
Yeah, that's very interesting, though, that the genetics there, that people that sometimes get involved in some of these ET-related projects for the military, that their offspring continue that tradition. So that seems to be pretty much what's happening in your case. Well, I know when we first met that you were very interested, and this was before you actually made your short film Stranger at the Pentagon. And I know you're still trying to raise the capital to make the full-length feature film. So why don't you tell us, what inspired you to kind of write a book, to produce a short documentary on Stranger at the Pentagon?
Well, interestingly enough, I read the book in the 80s. I was very enamored with the picture of Valiant Thor, his vice commander Dawn, and then another woman from the ship who they called Jill, who's the blonde woman. And I just thought that they felt authentic to me. And I just filed it away in a little cupboard. And then probably in the early 2000s, my casting partner at that time, we were partners for 10 years until she passed away. She was much older than me. She told me about two friends that she had who lived in Sun City, and that they saw saucers and things in the sky weekly. So she said, "I'd love for you to meet them when they come out here." So after months and months and months, they finally came out. And I met them. They were a very elderly couple. And the wife, she was very, very sweet. She had a sweet little Southern voice. And she said, you know, Craig, we see things all the time. And, you know, our friend, Dr. Frank. And I just went, you mean strangers? And she said, yeah, you want to meet them? Like that. And I said, yeah. So literally, I was having lunch with Dr. Frank and his secretary the following week. I just thought it was going to be a fan lunch, you know, me being the fan. And then we ended up just talking every single week. We became friends, started having lunch, dinner, you know, I got to know his wife well. And and just started hearing more and more stories. He had told me about several attempts to get the film made, which didn't happen. And so through just a little bit of time, well, actually somebody had contacted him right at the beginning when I met him and wanted to make it into a film. And he wanted me to go to the meeting, but the person didn't have the right credentials. So I warned him against it, and I saw how upset he was. And that's sort of how I got involved. And so I just sat with him. You know, I was friends with him for like the last 7.5 years of his life. I mean, we talked almost every day. I saw him at least once a week for lunch. But then I would just sit with him for some time and just hear him telling me all of his stories about being on board Victor One, the first time he met the vice commanders, which was many years later, and the first time that he visited the starship, and little things like that. And so I started crafting a script, and then when the script was completed, I gave it to Dr. Frank, and he said he would give it to Val. And he said Val came to his office early one morning, and he said that he just held it, he absorbed it. And I said, well, did he have any notes? And he said, no, just to tell you, good job. And but Dr. Frank had, you know, just a few notes that he wrote in the script. So anyway, that night, you know, I thought it was peculiar. There were no notes from Valiant. But when I came home, I went to sleep. And when I woke up in the morning, all of the notes were swimming in my head when I woke up in the morning. And that's how it continued, is they would just download the notes into my consciousness. And then I would go into the script and you know, adjust it accordingly. So, and then in 2008 is when we lost Dr. Frank. So I just, I put the project on a burner. You know, it was just so painful for all of us. And then, you know, several years later, his vice commander Teal, you know, who has spoken telepathically with me and also has shown me what she looked like through when I'm meditating and they pop in your mind. I don't know if anybody else has had that experience, but I get a little click on my neck and then boom, their picture, you know, their face is right there as if I'm looking at them. So I knew what she looked like. She said to me, it's time to make a short film. I want you to take these steps and we will do the rest. And so I took those steps and everything she said happened. But if I wanted, you know, at first we were going to make it on a small scale and with a smaller camera that you know, a friend of mine had. And I said, one day I said, wouldn't it be great if I could get a Red camera with a real DP? And then the next day one showed up. Just like that. So everything I was asking for literally came quite easily. A lot of stuff was donated. And, you know, we raised the money through campaigns and private donations. And, you know, we have, I think it was 82 or more visual effect shots in the little short film. That's a lot, you know. And so we found a little mom and pop shop that did actually pretty good. You know, they're not ILM, but, you know, I don't think anybody expected them to be ILM with a, you know, with the short film. I really made the film for investors as a proof of concept to say, look, if I could make it with just this small amount of money, think what I can do if you gave me the correct budget. Right. But then everybody wanted to see the film so badly. That's why I released it and I put it in a couple film festivals, you know, where it won, you know, best sci-fi film. So,
well, I remember meeting Frank Strange's, I think it was 2007, and we spent, just an hour, my wife and I, Angelica, meeting him. And then we brought him out to Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And I remember he had such a kind of sweet energy. He had that energy of your typical contactee, really sweet, sweet man. And, you know, I guess he was a reverend. But I kind of felt that, I mean, his story was absolutely real, you know, because he was a reverend, that he did meet with Valiant Thor while Valiant Thor was at the Pentagon for that three-year period in the 1950s. 8 to 1961, and so all of that was real. And I have watched your documentary or your short film, and I think it really kind of did touch on a very important point that here you have this this extraterrestrial there meeting with an American president, and yet you have this deep state doing everything in their power to undermine him and to kind of like attack him. So, yeah, do you want to talk a little bit about that dynamic there of, you know, Eisenhower wanting to engage, wanting to work with Valiant Thor, but the deep state wanting to sabotage and stop everything from moving?
Yeah, I mean, it was already told to the government, as Dr. Frank told me, well ahead of time that he was coming. So they knew he was coming, right? And that's why, you know, he was put on VIP status for 3 years. So he would talk to them about the dangers of atomics, the way the universe works in conjunction with planets, protocols, things of that nature, free energy, on top of eliminating sickness, disease, prolonging life, and all of that, which is interesting because he comes in 57 to tell that. And also a Nordic being named Salgonda comes to meet with George Van Tassel in 53 with that same protocol of regenerating the cells, how to prolong life, how to do all of that by building the Integratron, right? So we know that there was a lot of human contactees back in the 50s, even in the 40s. He came, he did, you know, Dr. Frank said he did help NASA in its infancy stages as well, that the astronauts were getting really sick. And so he helped them develop some nausea medication and some other things, he said. And you know, that also is interesting to me, you know, that he was there and he sort of was engaged in a lot of areas. Right. And I thought, you know, to have a created being, which is really an angelic in human form, right, to come and to be, you know, to teach and to share information would be a huge deal. I mean, I would feel safe knowing that was happening. But as Dr. Frank said, things he would tell them would fall on deaf ears, and then they had to pay the consequences in certain areas. So, so they did. They wanted his, you know, they wanted the organic technology of the ships. They didn't have that yet from what Dr. Frank said. And it just sort of was like this cat and mouse thing to see how they could outsmart him and do certain things. And, you know, Dr. Frank said that there were times that some of the darker, factors sort of moved in to try and get it through aggression and those kinds of things. But Valiantor is a creative being. You can't hurt him, right? So you can't even puncture the skin with a knife. You can't do any of those things, said Dr. Frank. So really what was very discerning to his vice commanders, his wife, to other crew members, was to see the heinous act trying to be perpetrated upon him, right? That somebody could do that to a being such as him, right? So anyway, as we all know, how it all worked out in the end is that the powers that be, not Nixon or Eisenhower, is they turned down the proposal because it would put doctors, nurses, pharmaceutical companies, everything out of business, and it would totally make the economy crash. Well, of course it would, because then everyone would be as they are up there. Everything is shared, everything is free, right? Everyone has when I say equal, there's many definitions of equal. Everyone is equal, but everyone still has positions and still works their way up the ladder into, if they wanted to be commanders or things of, you know, that sort. So, then he left 3 years later. He came back 1 year later. And started up his friendship with Dr. Frank again. They saw each other periodically. And then in 67 was the very first time Valiant invited him to Victor One. And that's where he first met the vice commanders. So, and then from then on, you know, just throughout the years. And then there's, you know, lots of stories of the, especially two vice commanders, Dawn and Thawn, being at a lot of the events or things that Dr. Frank attended. They would be in the audience, people would see them, or they'd see them in the hotel. I heard a lot of the people in his group that they had seen them as well. And, you know, I know that they always traveled with him to protect him, even when he went over into Europe and things like that in the early days. So,
well, let's move on to this four volume book series that you've finished. And let's start, you know, just if you give us a little bit of a summary of that first one, The Autobiography of an Extraterrestrial Saga. So, and you said this, you wrote that after a kind of second spiritual awakening. So
after the first spiritual awakening. Okay. Yeah. So there were three master teachers that came and woke me up. Mind you, I was just a kid in the valley, 26 years old, who went to work, went and had fun with my friends, never thought about anything out there in the universe, wasn't into science fiction, nothing. And all of a sudden, I'm having dreams with these three beings from somewhere else. And I would just wake up and my body would just feel love, like unconditional love. And then I sort of fall back asleep. And I kind of didn't think about it, but then it happened over and over again for 2 months, right? And then I would just ponder it and think about it. Then the next 2 months after that was me waking up inside the dream and realizing I was where they were at and that this was in fact something real, right? So then 2 months after that, I would go through the first two processes, wake up in my bed, and then they would be standing at the foot of my bed in their astral forms. Now, strangely enough, I never, ever was frightened. There was just this calm, this peace, this beauty, this love that was emanating from them. But I just didn't know who they were or why they were there, but they felt very familiar, right? And one of the next steps was they ignited my light body. And which actually it was interesting because when I woke up in bed, once I ignited it, I was on my stomach. I never sleep on my stomach. And one of them was holding my feet and my body was going like this up and down and slamming in the bed. And what they were doing was trying to equalize it. And I wasn't supposed to have woken up, but since I did, I turned around and saw that it was one of the master teachers. And then she touched my leg and I went back to sleep. And then I remembered that. But then after that, I started astral traveling to other worlds, meeting other beings in my dream states, talking before groups of different looking extraterrestrials, telling them about my experience here. Interestingly enough, Teal on Valiant Thorship, she's a teacher and she teaches all the beings out there about duality who want to learn about it. And then she has classes for people here on Earth who want to come up in their astral body. And she teaches them about beings elsewhere on Earth as well. So it's a little, you know, it's a little interesting that that coincided. And then the waking process just continued. And then after the end of the 2 years, there were two females and one male. The male said to me after a trip to Mount Shasta, he said, what would you say? Oh, by the way, when I was doing this, I wrote a book that was about all the experiences I was going through, right? And when I returned home from Mount Shasta, the male master teacher said, what would you say if I told you you just wrote that book for yourself? And I said, then I learned a lot about myself. And he said, now it's time to sit down and write the real books that you came here to write. He said, I want you to write and write and write. I don't want you to stop. I don't want you to edit. I want you to keep going until nothing else comes out of your hand. Now, of course, at that age, I didn't know what automatic writing was. I didn't know what channeling was. So I just hand wrote stuff out on, you know, big, long legal pads and, you know, and then bought a typewriter and started, you know, typing it up. And this is how these books were born. So at that time, I had three portals in my apartment. I had a little one bedroom apartment. And then when I would go into the kitchen to sit at the kitchen table to write, the portal in the living room, I would see their energies come down and they would gather behind me. And in the beginning, for the first month or so, my body would just ring with chills for like 15 minutes because their energy was so high and I was still raising my vibration. But it was the most fascinating thing, Michael. It was like reading a book. It was like listening to an audio book being dictated and writing it down. And the basis of the information is duality and how all of us here on this planet are learning to rise up and to ascend, to merge our duality.
Once we get to that place where we're using our heart to rule our mind, and we're service to humanity, service to universal kind, no longer service to self. And so the part of the book, it's interesting, is they explain that out of every 200,000 births in the universe, there'll be one person that's born dualistic, right? And that that it's so that in a fully conscious society, they will have a soundboard of somebody who's dualistic so that they can learn what it's like, and also for that dualistic person to learn what it's like to interact with people who are also fully conscious, right? And they do have schools and things for these dualistic beings that are born up there. But interestingly enough, the lead in the book, his name is Taran. He's a Pleiadian. He was born dualistic. And his story is a very interesting story because he ultimately becomes the head of the Starseed Alignment Program coming to Earth for messengers and mighty messengers. Messengers are people who are coming here with a personal experience to raise their own vibrations. Mighty messengers come in for to teach the masses, right? So it's very interesting in that respect. And we go along in books 1 through 3 of him overcoming his duality, and then he finally becomes fully conscious. So what's wonderful about it is the reader gets to become him and learn how to become fully conscious as well. And then the greater duality in the universe is between Archangel Michael and Lucifer, which is also a part of the books and the hierarchy, and it tells a lot about that tale, which is very fascinating.
Now, it sounds like you are really an experiencer / contactee. I mean, sometimes you know, people try to distinguish between contactees and experiences based on whether or not they're being abducted as opposed to voluntarily going on craft. But in your case, it sounds like you're having these spiritual experiences,
yes,
with these extraterrestrials, and they're wanting you to write this book series and filling you with the information. So this is really, I guess, you're an experiencer, mm-hmm, inspired, mm-hmm, by ETs to write a book about life in the galaxy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's about life there, and it's also about how they're raising this planet to up into become a fully conscious planet, so that we can therefore rejoin Universal Society, which we lost many, many thousands of years ago from degrading back into dualistic nature. So.
Can you maybe just elaborate a little on what it means to be fully conscious, and what is this universal society that we once were part of many millennia ago and are no longer part of that?
Well, they call it the Galactarian Alignment of Space Peoples and Planets. And so it's an alignment of people and consciousness. And we would call it... not to sound religious or anything like that, we would call it Christ consciousness. We could call it Buddha consciousness. We could call it fully conscious. It's really connecting into the heart and mind of the universe, into source, and becoming at one with the universe and understanding universal laws. But really, to become fully conscious, it's really mastering your emotions, so that your emotions no longer affect you and you're no longer reactionary, you understand why everyone is acting the way that they're acting. But in a fully conscious society, if someone's feelings are hurt or if two people are opposing one another in different beliefs, they actually will talk it through and have a healthy outcome, right? Where here, it could just be animosity for, right? So so there, you know, that's just sort of the simple explanation.
Mm-hmm. Reminds me of a saying. I remember Mahatma Gandhi said something along the lines that, you know, conflict is perennial, but violence is a personal choice.
Yes, exactly.
It's like, well, you know, I mean, mature couples or mature relationships, you're going to have conflict. I mean, you're going to have different points of view. But, you know, a sign of maturity is that you can talk it through and just, okay, yes. you can work it out. But, you know, immature beings, it's like, well, let's go to war.
Right. Have, yeah, you know, exactly.
And run over this conflict.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I found that there were similarities in your Tyron book series with the Urantia or Urantia.
Yeah, book. Urantia book.
Urantia. Yeah, you tell us about that. I mean, because that was very, because I know very little about it. I just know it was channeled at the beginning of the 1900s and somehow no one has claimed sole authorship, but it's this book of channelings that has kind of grown over the decades. So you want to tell us about it?
Yes, it's actually the things that are given by mighty messengers and angelics. You know, some mighty messengers are angelics that are there. The Urantia book really just sort of goes through the history of our constellation, right? It goes through the history of the planets. It goes through the history of Earth. It goes through the history of Archangel Michael as well, which is really, really super fascinating. And it's really a hefty book. It's about 2,000 some pages. And just so people know, you can download online for free. Or you can buy the book as well. I prefer the hard copy. And but it is really a bevy of information. And once you start looking into different sections, you just keep going from section to section and just learning more and more about it. I would say it does gel with the information of Dr. J.J. Hertak. Also in, you know, who wrote the Book of Enoch, the Keys of Knowledge as well, which is also one of my favorite books. So it's definitely something that people should get and check out. It made a whole lot of sense to me.
Now, I just wanted to kind of clarify the timeline here. Now, when you were having these experiences, age 26, and you're having all those downloads and those encounters and dreams and interactions, and you channeled, or you were doing the automatic writing. I mean, you did all that before you came across the Urantia book and before the J.J. Hertak's book. Is that
correct? That was, well, when I started the spiritual journey, I found J.J. Hertak's book. And in my youth, I found it very difficult to understand. So I didn't really quite grasp anything in it, but I would try and read it, right? So some of the things that, you know, I'm not sure when I got the Urantia book, but usually what would happen is I would be guided to go to a bookstore And then they would tell me where to go and then tell me to buy a book. And then that had something to do with it. And I'm sure that's what happened with your Urantia book, because it gives the actual names of all the places and things like that, which is what I was looking for.
Okay. Well, I know you wrote this extraterrestrial species almanac in what, the year 2000, 2021, and you describe 82 races. So, tell us about these 82 races that are interacting with the Earth.
Well, I just found it fascinating to, to study all the contactee cases. And, each one was a different experience for the people. The one that really sticks in my mind was a 14-year-old girl who lived on an Indian reservation, and they kept seeing the craft overhead. And her parents and the elders knew that they were going to take the girl for some reason, as I recall. And they did. And the beings were very different looking. They kind of resembled a lizard. They were in humanoid form. But she talked to the main one, and what happened was they put an apparatus on her head and on its head so that they could actually have a conversation. And what was interesting is because they did that, she was able to remember everything when she returned. So that's when Wendell Stevens found out about the case and went down there and actually, wrote the book about the Cherokee girl on the reservation and all of that. But basically, those beings can't come down here and actually interact with us. But through a contactee like this little girl, who was not afraid in the least, she was happy to share the information, that through her sharing the information, that people here would see that they're benevolent, right? So I found that one really, really fascinating. A lot of the races and humans had to come down here, and they had to live here. They had to pick a place where they wanted to live, and they had to be here for 2 years. They had to get a job, they had to get a place, they had to interact with humans. And there was, I think it was the Kaldashians, not Kardashians, Kaldashians. Their main guy was down here. I think he was in Italy for 2 years. And one of the people that he knew was actually a starseed, was from where he was from. So he entrusted that person as they got on to with, that he wasn't from here, why he was here, and that kind of thing. So I had to sort of learn about the Earth because, part of his being a commander was to be a part of the fleets above Earth and also protecting it and things of that nature. I know that a couple of Lemurians from Lemuria lived in San Francisco. A friend of mine is good friends with both of them, and so she relayed the story to me. One of them I was able to talk to at a later date. And then there's just interesting things throughout my life when I've been walking around. And I just look at somebody and I know they're not from here. And when I think that in my head, they turn around and smile. Right. So I think we've all had that experience.
Right. So of the 82 species that you discuss in that book, the Almanac, you would say most of them have people here on Earth living amongst us, interacting, kind of like learning about the culture? Would you say?
I would, yeah, absolutely. Definitely. Starseeds, lots of the human races, you know. I mean, for sure, Pleiadians, Arcturians, Sirians, Vegans, lots of them that were, you know, that are human, like us and can pass for us, are definitely living here, or hybrids of them as well, because they do make hybrids from star seeds, and then those hybrids will come down here and also live to sort of bridge the gap.
So, right. So yeah. Can you maybe just elaborate on how they make hybrids for the star seeds that come down here?
Sure. Yeah, well, there's, you know, the hybridization program is giant, far and wide. All races do it, but different races do it for different agendas, right? So we know that there's people who are abducted and their genetics are taken without their permission. So that is for those people's agendas. And I think we've heard those stories enough that I don't need to go into it. But then there are what we would call, what they call the seventh ray race, which is where starseeds have given their permission once incarnated here to give up their DNA. And then those are mixed with wherever that being is from. And then those children are raised up there. And they may come out part dualistic. They're raised to become fully conscious. And they're raised to sort of be teachers, facilitators that come and live on Earth and work in different jobs. But when the Earth changes over, those hybrids will then be set up, from what I've been told, all around the Earth to sort of be guides and help everyone with the changeover.
So the subtitle of your book, The Almanac, is The Ultimate Guide to Greys, Reptilians, Hybrids, and Nordics. And you describe two categories, benevolent and malevolent. So I just wanted you to maybe elaborate on how we tell the difference between benevolent and malevolent, because I know there are some sources like the Law of One books that talks about service to self versus service to other. So how do you tell the difference?
Well, first of all, the fully conscious beings want everyone to always keep in mind that to judge the individual and not judge the race, right? Just because there's fully conscious, there those beings that are fully conscious that can fall as well, right? And so really what we deal with is, you know, benevolent, malevolent, and then there's neutral beings, right, that are just sort of coming here, checking out the planet, doing surveying and things of that nature, or actually studying us as a race, and how some of those beings do it is that they do have permission for genetic material, and they will actually hybridize themselves to be us, to study us in that way. That way they're in bodies that can sustain themselves here more. But then as generations go by, they actually study us by becoming us, which I find very, very fascinating. And then, you know, look, if somebody has, it's interesting, I've talked to Yvonne Smith about it. If you're, you know, who's done many hypnotist sessions with abductees, same with Barbara Lamb, is that, look, if you see a gray in your bedroom and you're not expecting it, you know you're totally going to be freaked out, right? You don't know why that being is there and what's happening. You know, me being in the film business and people know that I'm into this, I've had agents, actors. One agent told me, he said, "Craig, they literally visit me every week. I am so freaked out because I'll wake up and it's literally staring like right over my face, staring into my eyes. And it just flips me out." And he said, "So what I do is I make sure that I stay out really, really late so that when I come home, I go to sleep and I don't wake up till the morning." Right. So, but just as Yvonne said, that a lot of people who were having those experiences with grays, that they realize over time that it is more of a benevolent experience. And each person's experience is individual, and it's about raising consciousness. We all know, you know, we can take it directly from Whitley Strieber, who first wrote Communion. I remember reading that book and being so freaked out, saying, "Oh my God, they could be in this room right now," and you know that kind of thing. So, and then, you know, benevolent ones, you're going to feel that if you're being visited, if you're taken up in your astral body and you're interacting with them, you are totally going to feel that. If you're abducted like Calvin Parker was, and Calvin had an extremely, he called her the evilest being he ever encountered. When I put him in the UFO hotspot book, you know, when I've talked to Calvin over the years and to, I said, "Well, what did she look like?" And Calvin would never say what she looked like. And I believe that he would not speak it, because if he spoke it, he felt she would come back. And he was literally terrified of her. So all these things really are based on individual experiences and that kind of thing. But it's kind of good to have a guide like the ET Species Almanac that kind of gives you an idea of the benevolent and malevolent, races and things like that. And also, you know, some of the neutral ones. But basically, most of the beings that are here to help raise the planet. To get it back up and so it rejoins universal society, which means rejoining the fully conscious community and that kind of thing, which I think is going to be I don't think we're going to be around to see it, but that would be a pretty cool day.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know we are going to head towards contact, and I think, you know, this is going to become a very important thing. I mean, how do you tell the difference between the benevolent and the malevolent? And on one level, as you said, I think it's easy. It's just you look at your feeling, you know what I mean, how you're feeling around these beings. Do you feel, you know, like positive, loving, peaceful, or is it like you're freaking out, you're feeling kind of threatened in some way? But then there's this other category which I find fascinating, which is the trickster. The trickster ET, like the used car salesman that comes across very friendly and wants to befriend you, but he's really wanting to like get you to buy the most expensive car. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like, and just kind of you're just the target to him. So how do you tell the difference?
You know, you can tell the difference if you have spiritually elevated to a certain plateau. You will understand that person is tricking you. I've known two people who have been ruined by tricksters, that they have gone into, I wouldn't say schizophrenia, but they're so freaked out that they're no longer their former selves, right? Because they got tricked into it, and then they're paranoid. They're paranoid when they talk to you. Oh, they're listening. They're listening in on my phone. You know, I'm like, they're listening in on everybody's phone. Not the tricksters, but, you know, anyway. So it's that. But I just say to people, all you have to do is just worry about raising your own spiritual vibration and don't get yourself mixed up in all of these other side things like tricksters and this and that. If you're just meditating and you're bringing that in and you're just pulling in all that energy, that's what you're creating around yourself. You're not going to create a trickster, right? But then if you meet somebody who has got trickster energy or a trickster attached to them, right, and then you start having these odd, strange feelings, you're just going to have to examine that, right?
Yeah. It's just, yeah, as you say, it's raising your frequency, your consciousness, mm-hmm. and just being aware that, you know, just because a being is smiling at you and trying to befriend you, that, you
know, right,
there could be a trickster there. So,
oh yeah, yes,
and we have kind of a lot of experience in that, a real world experience with tricksters. I mean, lots of con men, con women around that
are
always trying to fool us into buying things or subscribing to things. So, yeah, we do have real-world experience in that. So we just got to translate that into this coming extraterrestrial contact scenario.
Yes.
Well, one of the interesting categories that you discuss in the Almanac are the Agathans and the inner earth beings. Mm-hmm. So how are these Agathans and inner earthers different to extraterrestrials?
Well, they're originally not from here, right? The Agathans. So the Lemurians came from somewhere else. I don't know where they came from. I'm sure I found out, but I don't remember because I did have access to somebody who was quite close to Lemurian, directly from Mount Shasta. The Atlanteans were also not from here. And so we know that the Lemurian capital is below Mount Shasta. Posid is the Atlantean capital located between below the Mato Grosso in Brazil, and then Shambhala is the big capital of Agartha. Now, if we go back and we read about Richard E. Byrd's experiences and going into the inner earth, he also spoke about meeting a very spiritual priest, and that these beings were quite large and that kind of thing. So we know that in Mount Shasta, there's a Melchizedek priest named Adama. I believe that a lot of these priests are Melchizedek and they are the teachers for those beings, some of which I believe are fully conscious and some that may be, you know, not fully conscious. I'm not sure. So, evidently it goes far and wide, and they get around on these bullet trains that go extremely fast without motion sickness. And, you know, that's how they get from city to city and things like that. So, it's very fascinating in that respect. I know a lot of people have said they've gone inside of Mount Shasta to Lemuria, but astrally. I've had glimpses of it because I've asked to have glimpses of it. And so I've seen just blips of, you know, these glowing underwater lakes and, you know, beautiful, dwellings where they live. And, you know, some of the cities are, you know, they have rocks that glow as well, and which also helps with their light. But then they also have an inner sun as well. That's not like our blinding sun. And it's also said that some of these rocks, the Vatican has stored, many stories below the Vatican, these glowing rocks.
This order of Melchizedek. Now, you've kind of mentioned that a couple of times. I know J.J. Hertak talks about it in the Keys of Enoch, and I know it's actually mentioned in the, I think, the Slavic Book of Enoch, this order of Melchizedek. Mm-hmm. So as far as I can tell, I mean, is this kind of like a spiritual order of priests, kind of like a Jedi Knights?
Well, it's not like Jedi Knights, but it's Melchizedek. There's what we call the University of Melchizedek. It's 490 planets from one end of a galaxy to the other in the mirror system. And each planet we would call an advanced education sphere. So like on Earth, we're learning duality after we finish what we have to do here. Most of the time we go back to Melchizedek and we reevaluate what we want to learn. And if it's more in science, we might be assigned next to a planet that's science and we'll be born fully conscious and we'll have a longer lifespan of maybe 3,000 years. And that's the time frame that's given to us to learn all about that. Like in the fully conscious worlds, because they do live thousands of years, you're not considered an adult until you turn 70, right? Because you have all those years of studying the universe and studying everything, and then you really become an adult at 70. So, but Melchizedek is... you know, it's a great school. We have Father Melchizedek, and there's many other Melchizedeks, but on Earth there's 20,000 Trinity teacher sons that work with beings from behind the veil as well. And so on every planet there's a representation of Melchizedek. So if there's squabbles or things like that in the universe, what they do is they usually will send the emergency Melchizedeks, because they're well versed in counseling and they get results and to resolve any kind of situation that might be happening.
Yeah, kind of like spiritual peacemakers.
Yes, exactly. That's perfect. Perfectly said.
Okay, so the 24 elders of Andromeda, who are they?
Well, they're like I would call them super beings. They're so advanced, and a lot of the master teachers travel to them for counsel if they're trying to work something out in the section that they're from and they're not able to, right? They're not really quite sure how to handle it. They will go to the 24 elders, and the elders who are very, very advanced will give them their counsel, and then they'll sort of, then they'll travel back to, to where they come from. So they enter through a city called Beta Andromedae. It goes through these portals, and then they have to go through all of these slices of dimensions before they actually reach the elders. So that's Elder Elizalei and Elder Ahriman. They're the keynote speakers of the 24 elders.
Great. Now, there's also the Anunnaki. You talk about them in the Almanac, and there's a lot of divergence in thought about the Anunnaki. Some people view them as coming back, and that's a bad thing. Others see that they're coming back, and that there's a positive faction associated with Ea or Enki, and he is going to do the right thing and trying to atone for the past misdeeds of the other faction of the Anunnaki led by his half-brother Enlil. So what do you know about that kind of, the return of the Anunnaki, the different factions and these kind of long history of oppression and kind of atonement for that?
Well, I'm not an aficionado on the Anunnaki, but I will say that even gods like the Anunnaki, they do have also a learning process and a learning curve, and they also want to make things right in coming back and doing things. I don't really know the expanded nuts and bolts of the Anunnaki. So, you know, so I can only just give you the surface explanation.
Okay. What about the reptilians? Because I know that there's the indigenous reptilians that some believe have been here for millions of years, even before humanity. And there are the off-world reptilians who are the, like, you know, the real nasty bad guys, like the Draco reptilians. So you want to comment about that?
Well, just like us, there's so many different races of reptilians. There's, there's the really evil, aggressive factor of them, the Draconians. There's a lot of benevolent races of reptilians. Interestingly enough, I know somebody who... knows of a starseed who is a reptilian and whose reptilian mate comes to visit them from where they originally came from in the flesh. And I find that really fascinating. Now, it's just a story, but, you know, it's just fascinating to, you know, ponder if something like that really could happen. And definitely it could, because we know that many people have seen reptilians waking up in the middle of the night in their bedroom or being terrorized by them in their dreams and that kind of thing. So, you know, basically the Draconians just, you know, they believe that the universe belongs to them and they want to rule, and they've learned how to, over spans of time, how they can sort of, you know, infiltrate planets and rule them from afar without anyone ever knowing that they're actually in control of everything that's on that planet. So it's just fascinating. They don't, you know, they're not looking for immediate results. They know how to plan it, right? And to do it that way. Plus they have, you know, highly advanced reptilian brains. You know, their brains can also, they have a way where they can go on a hive internet, mind internet with other reptilians, and then they can shut that off and keep their individualistic thoughts. So, you know, I find that fascinating.
And so there's this most recent book that you did, the UFO Hotspot Compendium. So and you mentioned MUFON and asking you to work on that. So yeah, tell us about that.
So MUFON approached me after ET Species Almanac, and they said, we want to do a follow-up book. And it's sort of like a UFO bucket list of places to see. And what we'd like to do is we're going to send out to all the state directors to nominate their favorite UFO hotspot in America and Canada. And so they all did. And then I compiled them all. And then, you know, I started working with some of the MUFON investigators on cases that were old that they reopened. And so what you're going to find in a lot of the things that are talked here in the Hotspot Compendium, let's see here. So you get the when, you know, the when it happened, where it happened, if it's continually happening. You'll get the giant story of what's gone on there. The very first one is Giant Rock in the Integratron, which is my favorite, right? You also get the contacts of, like, if you were going to go to Giant Rock and you've never been there, you know, this is going to tell you how to do that. If you wanted to hire a a researcher who knows everything about Giant Rock. You can contact her and she'll take you out on a tour. If you wanted to go to the Integratron, it gives you all the information there. And you know, you have to know that you have to make a reservation. Otherwise, you just can't show up and go to the Integratron. So there's all of those things. It gives you the coordinates to where Valiant Thor's Victor One ship is located at Lake Mead, where Adamski met Orthon, where the Travis Walton story there, also the Lonnie Zamora, where that happened. It gives you those coordinates as well. But it gets into the story and it will tell you what either Project Blue Book or MUFON's date directors believe the end result was, even if there was no concrete evidence, particularly in the Lonnie Zamora case. Everyone, including J.L. and Hynek, believed exactly what Lonnie saw, right? Everyone believed him. There was a little bit of evidence there, but because nothing was caught on film or any of that, you know, there was no definitive evidence except for eyewitnesses and things like that, that were, you know, there was a family at a gas station who actually saw the ship flying over after it took off, after Lonnie spotted it. But, you know, again, this is an incident that ruined Lonnie Zamora's life for the rest of his life. When I was doing all the research for it, I contacted Erica Burley. She's one who painted the mural of him on the side of the road there, which is near where the spot where he saw the ship and the two beings. And, you know, she said she went and, you know, Lonnie had already passed away. But she went and talked to his wife, and his wife didn't even have pictures of him. All she had was a picture of him in his cop uniform. So that's what she painted. But she said that he was so freaked out for the rest of his life that he didn't enjoy his life. It just sort of put a damper on him, you know, seeing this. So, you know, these things do affect people in different ways. And, but you know, my favorite hotspot is, you know, is Giant Rock and the Integratron and Sedona. My favorite semi-creepy to creepy hotspot is the Bradshaw Ranch, which is just outside of Sedona in the Verde Valley. And that's, have you ever heard of that before, Michael? The Bradshaw Ranch? Oh, okay. Let me tell you just a little bit about it. It's originally Bob Bradshaw lived in Sedona. He owned a camera shop and he was a stuntman, a cowboy. So he bought thousands and thousands of acres of land so he could rent it out to a lot of the film companies coming in. He always played a stuntman, a cowboy, you know, something like that. They filmed the Elvis Presley movie on his land, several other movies. I think a Joan Crawford movie as well, a Western. And so he built his ranch there on his property as the oldest homestead in Sedona. And his kids grew up there. His second wife, Linda, when she moved in, Linda's son was in her 20s, and Bob talked about seeing a ship come in and land right in front of the ranch, which totally flipped him out, and he wanted nothing else to do with it ever. So on this ranch, the veil into other dimensions is the thinnest that I have ever experienced and other people on the ranch have ever experienced. They see things interdimensionally. When Linda's son would film things with a camera or an old, you know, because remember the old VHSs you had to hold because it was those times. In the viewfinder, he saw a dinosaur, but in front of him, of course, there's nothing like that. Another time they had a friendly albino Bigfoot, a woman, a girl, they called her Big Girl. And she was a constant visitor to where her horses were. Linda used to leave her food out, vegetables and fruit. And then she would gift her things on the plate. And then at a certain time, she was pregnant and she laid in the dirt and showed, you know, to show Linda when she walked out to get the plate in the morning that she was pregnant. And then later on, she started seeing little feet. Tom Dongo, who's a researcher there, he called her and said, you know, Linda, grays or reptilians are stealing the fetuses of the mares, so be careful. But she noticed that there was always white hairs on the belly of her mare, so she knew she was protecting her. And then once through the viewfinder, they saw a Big Girl walking with a UFO following her up above as well. So there's so many stories. They saw grays landed and were roaming around the property, walking by the front windows. They had veiled reptilians where their dogs were barking at something at night, and Linda went out and the dogs were looking up at something like this, and they were barking and they heard this hissing. Right. And so she got the dogs in. And when they went out there the next morning, they saw reptilian footprints as well. So, and this is just a little bit of stuff to sort of touch it. It's really, when I'm there, it's like I could feel all the dimensions are opened up. I've been sensitive to this ever since I was a little boy. And, I could see things looking in, and there have been experiences where people saw creatures walk out of nothing, continue, and then walk into nothing as well. So, it's such a hot spot. And I think, you know, maybe the producers of, Skinwalker Ranch, maybe they saw my book because, you know, they did an extension and they went out to Bradshaw Ranch and did two episodes on Bradshaw Ranch. So if you haven't seen it, make sure you see it on the History Channel. It's very fascinating.
Definitely. So right now, I mean, we're living in, I mean, what a lot of people think are the end times. I mean, it's just so much happening around the world. So in terms of extraterrestrial disclosure, this kind of end times prophecy that's all around us, so do you feel optimistic or pessimistic about what's coming?
Well, I totally feel optimistic. There is such a force of good energies, from angelic energies to fully conscious beings that are here that are really looking after this planet. Just as with anything, everything will get worse at the end, but then it blossoms and becomes anew again. I don't know if you've ever had my friend Chris Bledsoe on your show before. He has a book out called UFO of God, The Extraordinary Story of Christopher Bledsoe. He's in my ET Almanac documentary coming out in the summertime. But he had visits from the lady, and the lady talked about a lot of these prophecies and that kind of thing. And he also has an optimistic view of, you know, of how things are going to transform, and this, you know, how the world is going to transform and become anew. So I say to everybody, don't focus on that. Just focus on your day-to-day selves, working on yourself to raise your spiritual vibration. Don't put all of those frenetic energies out there in the universe. Just keep everything going calm and smooth, and we can create it in in a calmer way.
Wonderful. So any final words you want to say about current projects you're working on?
Yeah, we've got the Extraterrestrial Species Almanac, the documentary. I've been working on that for several years. It's completed. It's going to be out in the summertime. I'm not sure the exact date yet. And if anybody's going to contact in the desert, we're going to do a special sneak peek on Saturday, June 1st, from 6:30 to 8. And then some of the people that are in the film, including Paul Hynek, myself, the Hertax, JJ and Desiree, Tanya Maidenford, who you know, who's also the producer, she's flying out, and Yvonne Smith, and a few others. We're going to do a little Q&A after, so it'll be very exciting. I hope to have DVDs by then if people want to get them, but I'll have a bunch of the books there. So that's very exciting. And I've got two more additions to the Autobiography of the Extraterrestrial Saga books. They're just not out yet. I'm just completing them. So at some point they'll be out. There's going to be 7 volumes in the end.
So where do people go, Craig, if they want to find out about your books, your film projects? What are the best websites?
Well, for A Valiant Thor, it's Stranger at the Pentagon. You can watch a short film there, or you can watch it on Amazon Prime. I have all of Dr. Frank's out-of-print books there. The posters that you see behind me, that's the Victor 1 poster. That's our movie poster right there. And I think I have about 10 DVDs left, if anybody's into DVDs. And once they're gone, that's it. And then for all the other books, they could go to Autobiography of anet.com, just like it is on the screen. On the homepage is where the extraterrestrial, the Autobiography of an Extraterrestrial Saga books are. You can buy one or you can buy them all 4. They're in hardcover and softcover. And then if you go to other books is where you can find the Extraterrestrial Species Almanac and the UFO Hotspot Compendium, which I love the subtitle they gave it, All the Places to Visit Before You Die or Are Abducted.
Well, Craig, you've done a tremendous amount of work, put out a lot of information, and I think you've really helped educate people about extraterrestrial contact. And you're definitely doing incredible work. So look forward to talking to you once the Almanac documentary is out. Maybe we can do a follow-up.
Yes, yes. I would love that.
Well, thank you for being on Exopolitics Today.
Thank you so much, Michael.
You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.